Good morning and welcome to Cosmic Influence. My name is Walter Cruttenden and I'm here with co-host Jeff Patino.
How are you?
And once again, we work with the Binary Research Institute, which is an organization dedicated to exploring the possibility that ancient cultures might have been right in their almost universal belief that history or consciousness moves in vast cycles of time with alternating dark and golden ages, a cycle that Plato called the Great Year. And in exploring this concept, we look at the archaeology, anthropology, and the consciousness of particular different ages. And on that idea, there's been a number of books out lately that suggest that consciousness is more than just a human phenomenon. And one of those is the book that we'll be talking about today. It's called Son of God, and it's by Gregory Sams. Jeff, can you give a little background on Gregory?
Sure. Well, Gregory is UK-based, although he's American-born. He's done a number of things in his past. He's a fractal artist, social thinker, author, publisher, inventor, microbioticist. He's got a large background in microbiotic foods. And on top of all of that, he's the creator of the veggie burger.
That's something we really liked when we read about that. We'll have to ask him about that. So, and then let me just give a little intro here to the book. This is an intro by Graham Hancock, who most of our listeners know. He says that Gregory Sams' new book and new way of seeing will have a part to play in the global change of consciousness that is now, as never before, so desperately needed. Wonderful, clear-headed, thought-provoking material. So with that, Gregory, you on the line there?
I am. I certainly am. Walter?
Hey, it's a pleasure to have you here. And before we get into the book, tell me about the invention of the veggie burger. And I've been a big fan.
Veggie burger. I'd been selling. I was introducing natural foods and organic foods to England, the United Kingdom, from the age of 19, and that was starting with brown rice and sesame seeds and tahini and miso and seaweeds and a whole range of products nobody had ever heard of before. And that was really exciting, pioneering work. But after 15 years of it, the bank was about to take my house away. And I realized that, you know, however pioneering you do, you don't ever have any brand loyalty on brown rice. Somebody can always put it in a bag for a penny less than I can. And I thought, well, I've got to do something new, something, you know, that's going to be, you know, my product, if you like, and a pioneering thing. And I picked the veggie. I thought, well, there's no vegetarian burger out there. You know, why not take on fast food and take it on with the biggest product they've got, the hamburger? And I sat down and had a list of names, and, you know, green burger and plant burger and veggie burger and sesame burger and earth burger. And I kind of carried this list around with me for a few days and showed it to people and ended up with veggie burger.
And
which
this
I
was
trademarked because it wasn't considered a descriptive term at the time.
And this was back in the 60s then?
No, this was 1982.
Oh, 82, okay.
And I spent 6 months working on the recipe because I wanted it to be really, really good and the natural recipe. And it took off. It did really, really well. And it's kind of, and I would also run it as a virtual business out of a spare room in my house rather than having a factory with employees and forklift trucks and all of that stuff. And spent my time promoting and publicizing it, answering letters from consumers, and I loved getting fan mail. People, you know, you wouldn't think that the veggie burger would change somebody's life, but it did. It changed a lot of people's lives because it was the first thing that they could go out to the shops and buy that. And it was a mix, so they could make lots of other things out of it as well. We had a great recipe booklet that came with it.
Yeah. Well, it's been a staple around our house, so I appreciate you doing that. And I understand your roots before that, too. You had a health food store.
The microbiotic macrobiotic restaurant it started with.
Yeah, and John Lennon used to visit you there?
Who did?
Did you see?
John Lennon, John and Yoko used to come down to the restaurant a lot, yeah. And he'd park his white Rolls Royce outside. He'd be down there in the basement.
That's damn.
Yeah, no, that was, and he did a great cartoon for me when I put out a little magazine called Harmony Magazine.
Yeah, I saw that online. That's a very cool piece of history there.
How did you originally become interested in macrobiotic foods and natural products?
Well, I was fortunate enough to have been brought up with quite natural foods and home cooking in my diet, because my dad was nearly died before I was born. And medical science gave up on him, and somebody sent him to a Japanese doctor who basically put him on a natural food diet, not even frozen foods, let alone canned food, no sugar, no meat, and plenty of whole cereals and fresh vegetables and beans. And he was immediately, you know, cured within 6 weeks from and having been given up for dead. So thereafter, we didn't have much meat in our house. My brother and I were rationed to a teaspoon of sugar a day, and my mother baked our own bread. And when I became old enough to go out and eat sugar and crap like that, I did. But I had become a vegetarian when I was 10, because I didn't, you know, we ate meat in the house, but not much. And I didn't like it. So when I found out about vegetarianism, I said, that's for me. But I never knew, I never had another vegetarian in my entire school, right up through high school. I was the only one.
Yeah, this was back in the 50s, huh?
Pardon?
Back in the late 50s?
This was, yeah, the 50s, early 60s. And so my brother is the one who had Craig Sams, who discovered macrobiotics, because he was in college in Philadelphia, and he heard about this guy named George Asawa, whose shop in New York City had been shut by the FBI, not the FDA, the FBI, because he was writing books suggesting that a diet of hamburgers and milkshakes and cola drinks wasn't conducive to good health. And this was like a really seditious, un-American thing to say. And he said, well, these books have been seized and burnt. I want to read one. So he tracked down one of the books and, of course, immediately understood what macrobiotics was about. When he came back for summer holidays and told me about it, I was still in high school, I immediately got it because we'd sort of had that biological basis for it.
Was that the old Sanpaku really book? Is that what you're referring to?
Well, Your All Sanpaku is one of the books. Zen Macrobiotics is another one, and the Book of Judgment was another one. And they really changed our lives, and we became macroneurotics for a while, being very fanatical about it and shouting at our poor mom for putting one teaspoon of sugar in the apple pie and stuff like that.
Yeah, I myself started on a macrobiotic when I was in 1968. And I have stayed a vegetarian since, but added a lot more than just the macrobiotic diet, too. But
yeah, well, George Asawa said, you know, through a macrobiotic, can eat anything he likes. And, you know, macrobiotics, for me now, it's the way I approach food. It's not down to specifically what I eat, but I do eat, you know.
Yeah. Well,
pretty good core diet.
Yeah. Well, we better get into a little bit of the your book here, and just for our listeners out there, the book Son of God is spelt S-U-N of God with a small G and a large O. And a couple of the comments here from the website I like, it said, could the ancient Sumerians, Chaldeans, and Assyrians, the Egyptians, Greeks, and Romans, the Maya, Inca, and Aztec, and the early Nordic, Celtic, and Native American cultures have known something that we do not? Could the Christians have gotten it wrong? Well, what do you mean by that, Gregory?
Well, I just think it's the biggest cover-up in history. And you know, if you look at a time not so far back with the North Americans, further back with the Egyptians and the Sumerians, of course, and Neolithic cultures, it was once common knowledge, whatever continent, whatever culture, whatever century you were in, to understand that the sun was a living, conscious being. That which brought life to us enjoyed life itself. And it was something that came naturally. And then Christianity replaced that understanding with another God who was invisible and you couldn't see, but he was also a God of light. And as we know, there are a lot of similarities between the life and times of Jesus Christ and various sun gods and sons of sun gods that preceded him, whether Dionysus or Horus or Mithra, because they all, you know, the sun god's birthday was always the 25th of December, which is when days start getting longer again. And I just, what I find difficult to understand is how we've lost that understanding, because little children have it. Little children are always drawing pictures of the sun with a smiley face on their drawings.
Right.
But well, it's been sort of burnt out of our culture.
Yeah. Let me read Dean Radin's comment here, because I think it sums it up well. He says, "Son of God presents a perfectly outrageous hypothesis. The sun is a conscious, living organism residing in a thriving galactic community, thinking stellar thoughts that span the entire universe. Surely this is nonsense. Except that the more you read, the more a conscious universe begins to make sense. Gregory Sam's book is a clearly written and persuasively reasoned argument to think about the sun in a radically new and refreshing way." And that caught me, that concept that, you know, I was recently at the Tucson conference on consciousness, and about 85% of the people there were of the idea that, oh, consciousness is just a byproduct of an organism. But about 15% were, no, consciousness precedes the organism. Mm. And so it sounds like you're in the latter there.
I certainly am. And I mean, consciousness, it's an invisible thing, isn't it? And
certainly.
You know, there's no real basis for this assumption that it arises out of some particular combination of nerves and eyeballs and ears, and you get this right combination before, and voila, we have consciousness. It's an invisible thing, and these, as I see it, are the tools through which we experience consciousness. How the sun or an ocean or a thundercloud experiences consciousness, you know, would be completely other tools.
Right, right.
And what I find so interesting in today's day and age is that we know a lot about the sun and other stars and galaxies in the universe that ancient people didn't know. Ancient people looked up there, they felt this vibration, they felt the loving light of the sun, and they knew that it was another thing sharing consciousness. But we actually understand the mechanics of it, and when you look into the science of the sun and what's going on and what's going on with different stars in the galaxy, and you put that together with the knowledge of it as a conscious entity, it's a phenomenal picture we get. It's very exciting. And that's something the ancients couldn't tune into.
Yes. Well, as you mentioned, you know, all the sun and all stars are huge emitters of the electromagnetic spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think it was only 10 years ago that scientists were of the belief that, sure, the sun affects us, but no other star really has any effect on us.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in that year that there was one of these outages of the satellites and people's radios switching to, you know, faraway stations, ham radios going off the air, and the sort of thing that's typical in a coronal mass ejection, except this one was happening at night. And so that's when they realized that, hey, there's a not only this star, which they tracked down, but a number of other stars are affecting us. And it's almost as if there's a communication going on amongst stellar bodies as they emit certain frequencies and wavelengths across the universe towards each other.
I mean, we go to enormous lengths to create energy, whether it's power stations and of all different sorts to create that energy, and we don't just do it for fun to have fireworks and light shows. We do it because we use it. It's relevant stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the sun is going to enormous effort to produce various different types of energy, and people find different notes and tones and styles going on with solar flares and coronal mass ejections and filaments. And yet scientists assume this is all purposeless behavior, just random stuff that's happening. But I think there's a tremendous amount of communication going on. We've got a galaxy filled with stars sending electromagnetic signals out into space. And, on a smaller scale, we've got our brains filled with neurons sending electromagnetic signals out across synapses, having contact with a few thousand other neurons in our brain. And I think, we have to consider that the same thing is going on within a galaxy.
Yeah, and that's that really sums up sort of the premise of the book, and I appreciate you asking that question. Is the sun conscious? And there was another thought I read. I can't remember if it was a review or something on your website, or maybe your own thought that could the universe have really waited 13 billion plus years to create consciousness?
Yeah, I think that it strikes me as really arrogant and silly of us. We've been here 2 million years in a universe that's 13,700 million years old. We've been here like a few seconds, if you like. And to assume that we're the only things that have ever experienced consciousness. And, we might not be here tomorrow. And I just think it's a bit self-centered to have that sort of an opinion.
It's one of those things when you ask someone, talk about everything that's happened in the universe from the Big Bang up until now. It starts with the Big Bang, and then galaxies formed, and then the solar system formed, and then the Earth formed, and then life arose, and then here we are. It gets narrower and narrower and narrower until we reach the point of, and humanity, that must be the ultimate goal. And I think in the book Ishmael, the author talked about that, how if a jellyfish could talk and you were to ask a jellyfish that same question, they'd probably end up with, and then the Earth formed, and then jellyfish arose.
I made an analogy somewhere with eagles and a couple of other animals, and if you ask them, they would think, the world was designed the whole thing was designed specifically for them. And Earth, it's really just a speck of dust circling a rather average star and a galaxy full of stars and a universe full of galaxies. It's wonderful to be alive here, and it's kind of a paradise if we want it to be that we have, but it's not all there is. And I think it's partly just that is the headset, because for a long time people believed that the entire universe rotated around planet Earth, because it kind of looks like that. From Aristotle right up through the Christian Church and the Islamic churches, they were all quite convinced that the whole universe rotated around this little planet. And it was only a few hundred years ago when Copernicus and Bruno and Galileo came along that we realized, hey, no, that's not the way it is.
Yeah.
But a lot of humanity still believes, kind of does believe that, or acts as if that was the case.
Good. Well, hold that thought, Gregory. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Cosmic Influence.
Welcome back to The Cosmic Influence. Today we're talking to author Gregory Sams. He's the author of the book Son of God, Discover the Self-Organizing Consciousness That Underlies Everything. And Greg, right before we went to the break, you were talking about how we kind of arrogantly perceive that historically that the Earth and humanity has been the center of the universe. And that made me think of, I think it was Carl Sagan who brought up on screen during one of his talks a picture that I think one of the Voyager satellites had, they had turned it around and had it take a picture of the Earth as it was moving away towards Jupiter. And all it was is this tiny, tiny, tiny little blue speck in this vast field of blackness. And he said something that I thought was really profound, which was, we look at this little blue dot, and every life that's ever happened, every war that's ever occurred, every love that someone's felt has all happened on that little blue dot. And it really kind of put it into this perspective of wow, how significant it all seems to us being here on Earth, but in the grand scheme of things, how tiny we really are.
Mm-hmm. Greg, yep. When you say the sun is conscious, you're effectively saying that it has a type of consciousness or intelligence that is just unimaginable to us right now. Is that correct? Just almost inconceivable, yeah, in human terms?
Well, perhaps. I mean, we might be somehow tuned into it, but I think it's kind of unimaginable what a consciousness of that level thinks about, what sort of conversations it might have with other stars or communications with other stars. Maybe it's kind of like trying to figure out what, you know, like being part of a bacterial colony in our intestines, trying to figure out what the greater organism is doing or thinking about. It kind of dwarfs our own consciousness if you look at the electromagnetic activity, what's going on the sun, and you consider that all of our information processing and data is electromagnetic. That's how we send information back and forth, and you know, we're just a spark compared to the sun in terms of what's going on there.
I hear you loud and clear. Let me give one more just sort of endorsement that Stanley Krippner had put down. He said, in the brilliantly articulated chapters of this remarkable book, also provides a provocative paradigm for understanding the self-organizing capacities of the entire universe. And so your book really, it raises the concept, of course, that the sun is this vast intelligence, but it lends itself to a much more deeply spiritual philosophy, that the whole universe is just thriving with this consciousness and this life. Can you talk about that a little
bit? Yeah, it's... I'm sort of looking at how, you know, trying to figure out how does the sun form? And seeing these clouds of helium and hydrogen gas in the early universe self-organizing into this very complex body. Our star has seven different levels. They rotate at different speeds. They all have different functions and purposes that are going on. And I think, you know, for scientists to sort of say this is all accidental, this is just Newtonian principles happening to bring this thing about, is very shallow, very hard to believe. But and the other extreme, you've got Christians saying, oh, well, there was some, you know, big guy with a beard and white robes who put all this together, and somehow he shapes all these subatomic, you know, all these atoms of hydrogen into this complex thing. And because they're both really preposterous, hard-to-digest positions, and each one is strong because the other one is so hard to understand. And I was trying to look at some, you know, finding some different middle way, if you like. And you do have, in on the quantum physics level, physicists recognizing what they call mind-like behavior in subatomic particles in a plasma soup of electrons. They seem to be performing tasks and knowing what the other electrons are doing and getting about their business. And within a single human cell, you have several million individual components. Now, they're receiving messages, sending out messages, processing waste, rebuilding damaged parts, taking in food. And there's no real sort of central controller within that cell. In our own brain, we've got the same amount of neurons as you've got stars in the Milky Way. And there's no one clique of neurons telling the other ones what to do, any more than there's a clique of water molecules in a thundercloud saying, okay, now we're going to set up some lightning, and now we're going to, you know, do this and do that. And I... In between Veggie Burger and writing this book, I opened the world's only shop ever dedicated to chaos theory called Strange Attractions, because chaos theory is that wonderful new science in the late 80s that saw the self-organization, whether it was a rainforest or a thundercloud or a mountain range forming. They recognized this self-organization going on. And you've got now two mathematicians at Princeton, Professors Stanway and Koch, who developed the free will theorem. And they proved mathematically that either we have, that if we have free will, so do subatomic particles. And if we don't have, if subatomic particles don't have free will, then we don't. Ooh. Now, there are scientists who believe that humans don't have free will, and believe that every single twingle, bingle, dingle thing I say was determined by the arrangement of particles at the Big Bang.
That's a fascinating thought, and I want to get into that, the free will of quantum particles, and we'll do that right after break. Gregory, so you're saying that, that these two scientists at Princeton have a paper that says that if we have free will, then so must very small particles. How's that?
Subatomic particles, yeah. Electrons, protons, atoms.
That's an interesting thought. Now, please expand on that a little bit and what that means for your theory here.
Well, combining that with chaos theory, which sees self-organization of systems, complex systems where there's an uncountable number of components, each behaving independently and unpredictably, tend to form some sort of orders or systems, whether it's a weather system or currents you get coursing through oceans, or even a galaxy. A galaxy would completely collapse in on itself were not all the stars moving around independently, and that stops the sort of gravitational principles from pulling them all into one big lump.
Good point.
And that's probably, I would guess, how stars formed. You know, the same type of self-organization of cosmic dust, cosmic gas, forming this incredible energy-producing device. And some people, myself included, would maintain that if you know, if you can look at the before the Big Bang, and that's a bit difficult because we're looking at a, you know, let's put it a time before there was time and a place before there was space. But energy can survive in that environment. Energy is just vibration. It doesn't, it has no substance. It doesn't need a place to be. It doesn't experience time because at the speed of light, there is no time. So if it was energy that originally condensed into matter, maybe it was a big whoosh instead of a big bang, then it's interesting that one of the first things matter does is create an energy-producing device, a star. And then the star takes matter and elevates it into all sorts of other forms of matter. Everything other than the hydrogen in our bodies was originally formed on a star. Everything in the universe came, all the elements beyond hydrogen had to be forged on a star. And then those elements are, you know, we're an energy-producing device. We take in, we live on sunlight that is, you know, originally creates, you know, powers a plant, you know, and the energy in a plant that a plant stores up comes from sunlight. Animals eat that. We eat the plants, we eat the animals. We're recycling energy. So there's this sort of reproductive thing going on.
Right. Yeah, we're directly or indirectly, we're all totally dependent on the sun.
Yeah, and it's time we appreciated it for what it is.
Right, and like you say, it's a very, very ancient thought and one that's almost universal out there.
Yeah, and now that we know so much more about the sun works, how the sun works, it really underlines everything the ancients believed, makes even more sense in light of modern science.
Yeah, very, very much so. How did you originally discover chaos theory and come to learn and understand it? And how did your experience learning that lead to the book?
The first book I wrote was called Uncommon Sense, The State is Out of Date. And that actually applied chaos theory to our lives. And, you know, showing how things self-organize and making the point that, you know, when we have governments stopping that self-organization, saying, no, this is how this has got to be. You can't organize it yourself. It's too important for people to do themselves. We often end up, you know, in problem situations. That was my first book, and a few years after publishing that, I started off on a new book, which turned out to become To Be Son of God. That wasn't my original idea. And chaos theory came back into the picture again when I was sort of trying to grapple with the deeper questions. Okay, so the sun is alive, but how did it come to be that? And you see this self-organization going on really everywhere you look in the universe, from you know, a village pond to a cell in our human body to a galaxy. And that's really what chaos theory recognized. It was the first time that scientists saw this sort of thing going on, because when you're trying to confine something to a laboratory, you don't notice that bigger picture. And so it's kind of a theme of my life, I guess. But it made sense to me right at the beginning, because, well, it just did. Sometimes you hear something that really resonates, and as you live with it and play with it for months and years, everything else that you come into touch with, or contact with, fits with that new paradigm, and chaos theory is one of those things for me.
I love the thought you expressed here on your website. Can a tree be tickled by the ripple of a breeze? An ocean know its currents flow? A mountain feel its majesty. That's such a beautiful thought.
Yeah, I think I will have to agree with you, even though it was my own thought. And I even got down, I had to sort of go all the way right down to grains of sand in a later chapter. I get into that, and I say maybe they're even enjoying their life being, you know, shaped and reformed by the winds and the waves. And then, and after I wrote the book, I found out that you have singing sand dunes all over the world. Well, there's about 30 or so they've clocked. Sand dunes that actually produce these different notes during the day, and they're still trying to figure out the mechanics of how they do it. But, you know, figuring out the mechanics of things doesn't mean that they're not conscious. I mean, we know the mechanics of human beings. It doesn't mean that we're not conscious just because we know what our blood cells do and how bones work and stuff like that.
Right. Well, hold that thought right there. We'll be right back. You're listening to Cosmic Influence.
Welcome back to the Cosmic Influence. Today we're talking with author Gregory Sams. And Greg, right before the break, you had mentioned how the complexities of life and understanding, like, just because you can understand the mechanics of something, I think doesn't necessarily mean that you know how it works, per se. And that it's like, I think Douglas Adams wrote, the interesting thing about life is you can take a cat apart to see how it works, but the first thing you get when you do that is a non-working cat.
Yeah,
or magnetism. This is something we can explain, but we have no idea how it works.
Yeah. And light kind of falls in that category, which is the primary product we get out of the sun. Is this wonderful thing called light. And it's just a vibration. And again, you know, it has no substance. It's an actual vibration that is coming from the sun, and you go out in it and you know, shut your eyes and look at it and expose your body to it. It feels great. It feels fantastic.
I just think it's
so awful that so many people are frightened of it and covering themselves with creams and sunglasses and stuff like that.
I know. I was just out in the sun, and I was thinking about your book, and you actually gave me a greater appreciation for just feeling the sunshine a little bit.
Well, thank you. Thank you for sharing that with me.
Well, and it's one of those, I mean, light is one of those things we're fundamentally dependent on, even on the most basic of biological levels. Without sunlight, we can't convert certain vitamins that we need, and it's something that.
And there's no food. There's nothing to eat.
It would be very cold.
Yeah, we talk a lot about the waxing and waning effects of light when we talk about cycles on this show. You know, of course, the Earth spins on its axis, and it gives us a cycle of day and night, and the Earth moves on a slight tilt around the sun, which gives us the cycle of the seasons.
Yeah.
And it's this motion with the light that seems to create this whole show, or the variety of the show.
Yeah. In the original Zoroastrian god, the template for Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, was Zoroastrianism. And their god was a god of light, Ahura Mazda. He wasn't, you know, it wasn't an exclusive, jealous, you know, punishing god, but he was a god of light. And the sun was also a god, but like their representative. Light, you know, it's our local station of the light force. But light is, as much as we know about it, it's still a complete mystery, just even to the scientists who work with lasers and it's trying to understand light and how it conveys information to us about the world around us is. And whether it's a wave or a particle, it's a fantastic substance. And we just take it for granted because we're always surrounded by it.
Let me read one more of the reviews I read on your book here, which all of them are just great. Simply one of the wisest, most lucid, and thoughtfully written books that I've ever read on spirituality. Gregory Sams illuminates and clarifies my vague intuition about the cosmos being a living organism and adds flesh to my childhood hunch that every aspect of the universe is imbued with spirit. And Gregory, I got the same feeling as I was reading this book, and it really reminds me a lot of some of the Vedic thought. Have you? You're no doubt quite familiar with the sort of the Vedic philosophy.
I'm only tangentially familiar with some of that. I did have a quote in my book, which was attributed to Seneca, and luckily before the final print went, I found that it was from the Vedas, and somebody had misappropriated it to Seneca, but it was absolutely right on recognizing the I can't even find the quote now, but it was and then I read some of the Upanishads. I'm not even sure how you pronounce it, and so people have been here before. And I'm not really discovering new stuff, but I'm putting it into the modern context in the book is what I found fascinating. And it did. Writing the book had the same effect on me as reading it had on you, because it was a voyage of discovery. I'd always thought the sun was conscious, but I'd never actually pursued it and said, well, what does this mean, It does. Looking at our universe and our world in the light of a conscious sun just reveals so much more than we ever thought. And I think it's particularly appropriate today because there's a lot of interest in Mayan and Egyptian and Vedic culture and ancient Celts and Stonehenge and pyramids. And yet, the one commonality to all of those ancient cultures was that they recognized the sun as conscious, and that's something that a lot of modern researchers tiptoe around. And that's my real goal, is to bring the sun out of the closet.
Yeah, and I agree. I think we really are just barely beginning to understand the depth of knowledge that ancient cultures and ancient peoples had. And are just now at the point of starting to appreciate that, and not look at our ancestors as people who were just kind of gathering stones and not really paying attention to the world around them and the cosmos around them as well.
Yeah, they were much more tuned into nature than we were.
And Gregory, your website is www.gregorysams.com. If people are
Sams with a single M,
are more interested in finding out more about your work, and because you've done some great research, and we really thank you for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks so much, Gregory. Yeah, we just have about 30 seconds here, so people can go to your website, and once again, the name of the book is Son of God, with a small G, a large O.
And an S-U-N for the sun.
Right. And it's available on Amazon, I'm sure some of the major bookstores. So thanks again for being on the show here.
Thank you, Walter. Thank you, Jeff. It's been a pleasure.
I look forward to meeting you someday.
Okay, I hope so. If you're ever in England, give me a call.
Will do. Thanks much.
Okay.
You're listening to Cosmic Influence. We'll be right back. Wow, I really, really enjoy this subject. The way that Gregory has blended science, and from quantum science to sort of cosmic thoughts with spirituality, is just really hits home with me. He's done a great job.
Yeah, and for an equally cool blending of science and spirituality and ancient knowledge, be sure to check out the CPAC conference, which we have coming up this October 10th, 2009. It will be at the Beckman Center on the UCI campus. You can learn more about the conference at cpaconline.com. That's cpaconline.com.
That's right, and we hope to see you all there. Once again, thank you for listening to Cosmic Influence. And in the meantime,
bring on the higher ages.